Hello, and welcome once again to Learning Digital Photography. I'm your host, Jason Anderson, and you are listening to episode number 31. On this week's show, we're announcing the winner of the September contest giveaway, a $500 prize package courtesy of the folks over at Topaz Labs and Think Tank Photo. We've also opened up the October giveaway. The Flickr thread has a couple entries in there, and more photos are bound to come in soon with this cool prize package. So you're going to want to check out the details for that coming up after the intro here. Last up, we are going to take some listener questions and some answers to those questions for rounding out the show this week. All that's coming up right after this, so don't go away. Welcome back to Learning Digital Photography. First up, the big news that everyone's been waiting on. Who's going to be the winner of the $500 giveaway package? This includes a Think Tank multimedia bag system. You've seen me review it on the blog. I even think I did a video on this and shared that up on YouTube. And that's worth about $300, $250. And there's also a $150 Photoshop plugin bundle from the folks over at Topaz Labs. Two sponsors for this huge giveaway. Thanks very much to both of them for sharing their products with us here at Learning Digital Photography. But you've waited long enough, so I'm not going to lead you on any further. The winner of the $500 giveaway is Brian F. Brian F. over on the Flickr forum thread for the September giveaway shared just a fantastic image of some flowers. Just had some really amazing colors that popped. He was one of six finalists I had chosen, and I had shared these results with the vendors, and we ultimately came to the conclusion that this had the best overall color quality and composition that we were looking for in this contest. So congratulations to Brian. You are the winner of the $500 package. We'll be getting in touch with you shortly to get all your details so this bag system can get mailed to you and so you can get the software bundle from Topaz Labs. Congratulations to Brian on a job well done. Now that the September contest is finally closed out and we are already into the October contest for the month, the theme for the October contest is fall. With fall and autumn being on the way, I figured that is as good a theme as any for this giveaway. So we're going to be falling in the month of October. But here's the catch. You're going to fall into noise because the winner is going to get a copy of Noise Ninja. This is a popular software noise reduction program that you can use to reduce the amount of noise in your photos. It's very popular. It comes to us courtesy of the folks over at Picture Code. So thank you to them for sponsoring the October contest over at Learning Digital Photography. I will throw a link to the Flickr thread up in the show notes, and this is a prize package worth about, I think it's $100 for Noise Ninja, so you're going to want to make sure to get your photo in. You can submit up to three photos in this contest. Your photo needs to be no larger than 800 pixels on the longest dimension and no smaller than 600 pixels on the longest side. So longest side between 800 and 600 pixels. This actually makes things a lot easier when I go to draw up the finalists and put them in a web gallery there. So please make sure your images are between 600 and 800 pixels on the longest side. The theme you already know about. You want to make sure they're work safe, family friendly. I know there's a lot of people that like to push the envelope a little, but because this does go out to a wide variety of people, we ask that you keep it work safe, family friendly. You can go up to 30 days outside this time period. So if you shot something in September that wasn't suitable for the previous giveaway, but would be suitable here, depending on where you are, your fall season might have started sooner. You're welcome to submit something from that time frame as well. We are asking for three image limit though for each participant, and that pretty much wraps up the conditions and guidelines for this giveaway. The standard stuff applies as always. If you have questions, stop over to the Flickr thread, look at the guidelines there, or if you have something specific that may not be addressed, feel free to email me. The address is jason@canonblogger.com. So that is the contest news and announcements for this week's podcast. Coming up in just a minute here, I'm going to be talking to you about how to frame your photos. A lot of people have been asking questions about this lately. So I thought it might be worthwhile to take some time and talk about a couple options to consider when matting and framing your photos from the do-it-yourself perspective. So that's coming up after the break. I'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back. In this segment, I'm going to be talking to you about how to frame your photos. Well, a lot of people are asking how to frame your photos, how can you save money, what's the do-it-yourself route, is it worthwhile considering, what do you have to take into consideration? Lots of questions here, lots of great questions actually, so I'm not going to be answering any of those in the listener question and answer segment today, but there are a couple things that you want to keep in mind when you go to mat and frame your photos. This is assuming, of course, that you've already done the printing process and you've got the printed result and you want to display this on a wall somewhere. It really is going to depend on a number of factors, whether you're putting it up and displaying it inside your house, inside your office, or if you're doing matting and framing for things like art shows, galleries, contests, things of that nature, because different venues will have different requirements. Now, if you're doing it in your house, the only requirement is your own personal preferences on how you want it to look. But if you're doing things for art shows, galleries, contests, things of that nature, there will be some restrictions on and guidelines on what you can do. For example, the size limit may be one. They may ask for museum-style framing and matting, things of that nature. They may have specific hanging requirements. They have to be framed and ready to hang on a wall. They may use specific devices there. All that is stuff that you want to consider when you mat and frame your photos. And I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the do-it-yourself method here and then some other options as well. Starting off, when you do a print, when you actually take a digital print and you go to mat it, you have to remember that most of the time you're going to be doing inkjet printing of your photos. And because this is ink that's lying on the surface of a photo, it's not being absorbed into the actual paper itself, as soon as you go put a mat on that photo, that mat might start sucking up ink off the surface of that paper. So you want to make sure that you're getting a good mat that won't do that. Good mats are referred to as archival mats. That's archival. It means they have a good archival quality. They won't detract from the quality of your image over time. You can get these fairly cheaply. I use a website called ReadyMat. That's R-E-D-I-M-A-T.com. I'll throw a link to that in the show notes so you don't have to worry about writing this down if you're jogging or driving or on your commute or something like that. So that is something you want to consider when it comes to matting your photos. And most professional shops, most pro shops and art stores will take care of that for you. So that's something you shouldn't have to worry about if you're having it done professionally. Just specify to them that you would like some archival mats and they'll make sure that the quality is there for you. The other thing you want, a big thing that you want to consider when it comes to framing your pictures, is that you use conservation glass. There's a couple different grades of glass. There's just standard glass. There's non-glare glass. There's conservation glass. There's conservation non-glare glass, things of that nature. And at a bare minimum, you want to make sure you are at least using conservation glass for your framing, because the conservation glass will prevent UV rays from going through the glass and deteriorating the quality of your images over time. This is where you see that picture fade kind of thing. So if you don't use conservation glass, your images can be susceptible to this fade. Highly recommended that you use conservation glass when framing your photos at a minimum. I would also recommend that you use the non-glare option when it comes to the glass for framing your photos, because the non-glare will prevent glare from exterior lights bouncing off your frame, so people won't be distracted by that. It is a cost consideration, though, because the higher the quality of glass that you get, if you look at standard glass versus conservation glass will be more expensive. If you look at conservation glass versus conservation with non-glare, it will, of course, be more expensive there as well. And this all, of course, is a function of size, too. The larger your print, as a rule of thumb, the more expensive it will be to mat and frame it, which is why a lot of people, I think, are going the do-it-yourself route. And you can get glass pre-cut to certain sizes. I've got some 11 by 14 frames. I talked about this on the blog the other day and took a few quick snapshots so you could see what it was I'm talking about. But you can get glass pre-cut, so if you want to use a standard size frame that is pre-cut, pre-made, and swap out the glass, you can do that. But that's getting a little beyond the scope of this. I just wanted to put that out there, the archival mats and the conservation glass, as recommendations when it comes to matting and framing your prints from the do-it-yourself perspective. Stepping back just a little bit now and looking at just the mats, there are a couple options there. You can go to stores and buy pre-cut mats. You can get these from any hobby store, whether it's Hobby Lobby or Michaels or wherever your local art store happens to be. And you can buy these fairly inexpensive. You can get them for probably anywhere between $5 and $10, depending on the quality of the mat that you're getting, as well as the size of the mat that you're getting. There's different color combinations that you can look at as well, and you can also get some that have an offset or have a little cut around the inside edge of the mat there. That's called a beveled edge. And if you have more cuts there, if you have multiple colors involved in a mat, that can increase the cost and expense as well. For me personally, I like white and off-white mats, and I only use one color and one little beveled cut inside. So that is just a personal preference. I find that the classic look is a little more effective there. And that's always something that I would recommend, because it's easy to find and easy to match. You don't have to worry about certain color of mat not being produced or a shade difference if you go back and buy more later. White is very easy to reproduce, or an off-white is very easy to reproduce as well. And that is, in general, is a good rule of thumb to follow. If you pick a particular mat style with regard to the color, you want to make sure you can reproduce that color perfectly, because you want to have consistency, especially if you're talking about setting up a gallery show or submitting artwork to a contest or things of that nature. You want to make sure that people aren't distracted by various colors all over the place on your mat or various frame styles all over the place. You want to get people looking at the photo itself. Remember, the mat and the frame should complement your photography, not distract from it. You want the point of focus to be the photo, not the presentation behind it. If the presentation behind it is better than the photo itself, people aren't going to notice the photo as much. And you may hear people saying, "Wow, I love that frame, but what is that photo?" You don't want people doing that. You want people just looking at the photos and saying, "Oh my God, that's incredible." And the way to do that is to go with something that doesn't distract from the photo itself. I find that the classic style, I'm referring here to museum framing as well. I'll get to that in just a minute. But it also means a simple white border, usually a 1-inch border or a 2-inch border, depending on the size of the frame and the size of the print that you're talking about. So that is something you want to consider there. Moving right along, there is a little bit about the framing that I'd like to talk to you about, because there are several different framing options available. And the first of these is actually making your own frames. You can make your own frames. This will reduce the cost of your framing materials immensely over the long haul, but the problem lies in the upfront costs as well. And actually, I'm going to backtrack just a little bit, because this also does pertain to mats from the same perspective. You can actually cut your own mats. You can get big size mats, like 4 foot by 8 foot or 2 foot by 4 foot size mat boards, and then cut them to size yourself. So you can cut the outer dimension how you want it. You can cut the inner dimension how you want it. You can cut a border inside there, and you can stack them and do all kinds of stuff and really come up with a cool, you know, really unique approach. But the problem here is that you are going to need supplies in order to do that. Not just the mat board. You're also going to need a mat board cutter. You're going to need blades. You're going to need to be able to store this kind of stuff. And storage is another big concern. And then there's also the learning curve factor, because you're going to screw some of the stuff up. You're going to mess up, at least initially, as you learn how to do things like cut mat board and cut frames and assemble mat boards and things like that. And what about hinges? Don't forget that you have to hinge or attach your photo to the mat itself. How are you going to do that? There's a lot of options there. You can go from using low-tack adhesive tape to spray-on adhesives to hinges, which is the preferred method for art galleries. And all these types of things cost money as well. So if you want to go the do-it-yourself method with matting, these are considerations to take into account before jumping in. Because if you decide you're going to save money on matting your own photos, and you end up spending $50 to $75 on a mat cutter, and you're spending another $10 to $20 on blades and another $10 to $20 on adhesives and hinges and things of that nature, before you know it, you spent over $100 just on the supplies to cut your boards. And if you look at spending $100 on mats, you can get quite a few mats for under $100. So that is something you want to consider when you go the do-it-yourself method. There are some pros and cons there. Like I said, one of the cons would be the startup costs involved. But the joy of actually creating your own mats can be quite empowering. And over the long haul, the costs of those supplies will drop with time. So it really depends on what your tolerance is as far as these things are considered. I'm actually going to take a quick break so we can break this up a little bit so you're not listening to me talk for too long without resting your ears. And when I come back, I'll go into some details about the framing side of things, and you can look at the pros and cons there as well before deciding how you want to frame your photos. So I'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back. Now, when it comes to framing your photos, there are similar considerations to take into account. You've got a lot of options available to you, and I'm going to talk about three of them. The first of these is making your own frames, building your own frames from scratch. This can be a lot of fun. It can be very empowering as well, just like with mats, but there are startup costs involved. For example, you're going to need a miter saw. A miter saw is something that will allow you to cut wood or whatever it is you're using to create your frames at a 45 degree angle. It's very difficult to get that exact without a miter saw, so you would need a miter saw in order to do this. The other thing you're going to need, obviously, is a tape measure, so you're measuring the right length for your photo and your mat board as well. So there's another cost involved there. You also are going to need nails. You're going to need some way to adhere each frame segment to one another. And these startup costs can be pretty substantial when it comes to building your own frames. You also have to be pretty good with woodwork. This isn't something that you can just slap it down, cut it, and it'll automatically fit together. It's, again, a learning curve kind of thing, so you're going to waste some of your supplies and materials in learning how to do it correctly, and that learning curve tolerance can vary from one individual to the next. So if you're good with your hands and you think you can pick this stuff up kind of easily, you may want to go to like a Lowe's or Home Depot, see if they have classes and things like that, because they do sometimes offer free things here and there. It's definitely worthwhile considering if you want to make your own frames. I personally chose not to go that route. There are two options that I use. One is to buy pre-made frames, pre-sized frames, from a hobby store. And I usually go to Michaels and Hobby Lobby. I can I watch these stores for sales, and I picked up six frames, I think, the other day. Four or six frames the other day from Hobby Lobby for a grand total of $12. They had a 50% off sale going on. It was a really good deal. It was the same style of frame that I'm used to, so I went ahead and picked some up as I try and build out my gallery with a consistent look and feel all across the board. So that is one route you can take by looking at framing shops and stores in your area, hobby stores, things of that nature, to look for pre-made frames or prefab, I guess, for lack of a better phrase, prefab frames in the sizes that meet your needs. Another way you can go, or another route you can go, is through online resellers of frames. A company I used relatively recently is called American Frame, and what they did is they sent me all the frames. I ordered a 50 pack of frames, and got them insanely cheaply. And what this included was the frame itself and a custom cut mat. So I specified the dimensions I wanted on these mats, and I spent like $50. So $50 on 50 frames and 50 mats was a really good deal. They're archival mats. I really couldn't say no to it. So I went ahead and got that taken care of. And what these do, these are frames that you assemble. So there's a little L bracket that slides into a groove on the back side of each arm or leg of the frame, or each element of the frame. So you slide these little things in, and you have to take a screwdriver and tighten it down so the thing stays in place and syncs up in the corners so that the miter cuts can match up for a nice smooth finish. And you take your mat board and you slide that in the front groove, and then you take your photo with the mat attached to that and slide that in front of that. Then you take the glass for your photo and slide that in front of that. Then you put the last top piece down and you put the little L brackets inside on the top and screw those in and make sure everything's all adhered nice and tight there to help conserve the image behind the glass. And it is a little more labor-intensive than, say, a pre-made frame where you just pop a piece of plastic or plexiglass off of a frame and throw in a picture with a cheap mat. But the quality that you get and the resulting display quality of the image when you have it hanging on a wall inside an art show or a gallery or a competition or contest or even in a wall on your house, the resulting quality will be evident, and I think you'll enjoy your photos a lot more. So that is the second option. The third option is to actually have your photos professionally framed. Everyone knows about these frame shops. We see them all over the place, and these are people that do framing consistently and professionally every single day. So they're going to do a superior job when it comes to framing your photos. You do pay for it, though. It is a service just like anything else. And the cost of matting and framing will, of course, escalate from there. But the resulting effect when you see these things hanging on the wall will just be amazing. So depending on what your risk tolerance is and what your cost comfort level is with regard to matting and framing your prints, you can start off at the bottom of the barrel where you are picking out your own mat board and you're cutting it out yourself and you're popping your photo in yourself and you're cutting out a frame and nailing the frame together and assembling it all yourself, where the long haul cost wouldn't be all that great. But you also are spending a lot more time on the process and you're not out shooting. So those are trade-offs to consider there as well when it comes to matting and framing your photos. The last thing that I want to talk to you about when it comes to matting and framing your photos is actually something fairly new that's become available to a lot of consumers. And a friend of mine, Rich Charpentier, you all know him from the podcast. I interviewed him a couple months ago, is the option of going with a canvased print. Now, a canvas print is basically a print that's run through a printer that can accept canvas as a medium rather than photo paper. And what's nice about this is the canvas just stretches and wraps around, and it can be a cheap wooden frame that it just wraps around nice and tight, and then the print itself also becomes the frame. And you don't have a mat, you don't have the need for a mat, you don't have the need for the conservation glass, you don't have a need for the frame, except for the wood one that it attaches to when you stretch and put it together to assemble for hanging on a wall. And it also looks really, really cool. If you've never seen canvas prints before, go just do a Google search on canvas prints and you can actually see what these look like. It's a really cool and interesting effect. It's really good with landscapes. I like how landscapes look. And portraiture also looks really good through the canvas medium as well. If you have any questions about canvas prints and how to do them and what the perils and pitfalls are, I would recommend actually going over to Rich's blog and website. He actually does this professionally for a living and knows what he's talking about and can speak to it much more intelligently than I can. I'll throw a link to his website up in the show notes as well if you want to get more details there. Okay, so that is it for the matting and framing. Like I said, you want to make sure that you are getting archival mats and at least conservation glass when you're doing your own framing. And those are the two big things to consider. Coming up after the break, we're going to take a couple of listener questions and answers. So don't go away. I'll be back right after this. Well, Welcome back to Learning Digital Photography. For our final segment today, I'm going to be covering three different questions that came into the blog. The first one comes to us from Amy in Seattle, Washington. Amy writes in to say, "Dear Jason, I'm getting a lot of enjoyment out of your podcast, blah, blah, blah." She is asking about triptych styles of photography. She's asking for an explanation, more of what this is, was a little unclear. Amy, this is a great question. Actually, I saw this asked by someone else on the blog as well. Basically, what triptych refers to, it's a Chinese term, but if you think about its translation into English, that trip means there's a triple set or a triple series of images. So basically what you're doing is you're taking an image and you're cutting it into thirds, and you can do a triptych either going horizontally left to right, or you can do a triptych going vertically. Typically, the standard triptychs that I've seen are horizontal in nature, so you'll have a third of the image printed out on one image or one section, and then the middle third will be printed out in another section, and then the right third will be printed out on another section, and then you'll display them sequentially next to each other. And that is the traditional format that I've seen, the horizontal, but I have seen a few verticals from time to time. It puts kind of an interesting twist, a nice little added a sense of depth or dimension to photographs that you might not otherwise see in a single print. But that is what triptych or triptych refers to. I'm not exactly sure how it's pronounced. I just say triptych because that's what the letters say to me. So that's what a triptych is. It can really add a nice dimension to work. I see it a lot in art galleries. It seems to be pretty popular in more recent years than longer ago. But that's what that is. It's a great question. Thank you to Amy. Our second question comes to us from Mike Olson. This came in from the blog. Mike writes in to ask, do colorimeters work on wide gamut monitors? Just is really a technical question, so for those of you that may not be into the techie side of things, you might want to skip on from here. But it's a really good question because different colorimeters will have different capacities as far as what they can set your monitor to. And the best recommendation I can give is to check with the vendor for the particular colorimeter that you're using, because they will usually list on their website the monitors that they support for things like push-button calibration. They'll also list the specs for their colorimeters and say what the gamut range is for that particular one. Since he's asking about the X-Rite, he's actually asking in reference to a blog post I did about calibrating your monitor with the X-Rite Great Tag Macbeth one, because I used that one. And in answer to your question, I'm pretty sure it does, because I remember when I first did a calibration, it asked me for the white space that I was going to use, whether it was going to be for a fluorescent light or for a flat panel monitor or for a CRT monitor. And there's also the option to measure out the ambient light that's going to be used, and all that is used in conjunction to define what that red value is going to be, and it's going to be a function of the color space that you're working within. So when you first are plugging your X-Rite R1 Display 2 into your computer, it will actually probably prompt you to define what color space you're going to work within, whether it's Profoto, Adobe RGB, sRGB, things of that nature. And the wide gamut colors space that he's referring to with regard to monitors would be more the Adobe RGB and the Profoto color space. Profoto is gaining a lot of traction because that's what Lightroom uses, and as monitors become more capable of displaying these ranges of colors, you're going to probably see more and more people printing and outputting in these larger, wider gamut color spaces. And to my understanding, I believe, and this isn't 100% sure, but I believe that the X-Rite colorimeters do cover that color space. Again, you would want to check with the X-Rite website specifically to make sure of that. I can't give a 100% guarantee. And the same holds true for any product. If you ever want to know specific technical details about a product, always, always check the vendor website, even email customer support and ask. You can always do that. The site for the X-Rite, surprise, surprise, is www.xrite.com, and then you can query by region, and it will ask you to click on US or click on UK or wherever you happen to live, and then just select the product you want. It will give you details for what it can and cannot do and what the specifications are. That's a great question. Our last question comes to us from Chris right here in Colorado. Chris wrote into the blog, actually wrote into me via email. and asked if I'm doing any workshops in 2010. It's kind of an interesting question, Chris. I actually have toyed with the idea of doing some small workshops of interested growing photographers, learning about the craft. And I am thinking about doing something for 2010. I don't have any details or specifics defined as of yet, but I do think it would be a fun experience to bring some people into a workshop environment so we can go over things on a start-to-finish kind of basis. If you're interested in participating in a workshop, let me know the subject matter that you'd be interested in, and if I can generate enough interest in that, we may just have a workshop or two coming out for 2010 from here over at Learning Digital Photography and over on the blog at Canon Blogger. So thank you very much to Amy, Mike, and Chris for the questions that you wrote in about. Gave me a good opportunity to let you know what I'm thinking about for coming up next year, as well as things that are going on currently. Feel free to stop in to the blog if you have any other questions. There's a comment section in there. You can comment on any given post. You can also ask questions to me via email. The address, as always, is jason@canonblogger.com. Thanks for tuning in, folks. Have a great weekend, and happy shooting. Just a quick final postscript for the show that I did not mention during the regular podcast, so consider this a postcast, if you will. But the Canon Blogger newsletter, which I just started the month of October, which is a review of everything that went on in the previous month, is looking for a featured artist section. So if you're interested in being a featured artist on the Canon Blogger newsletter, and I'm probably going to play with the name there a little bit, but if you're interested in participating as a featured artist for the newsletter, drop me an email, jason@canonblogger.com. Thanks for tuning in. Happy shooting.